For close to 2 years, Sharon Mahari was a well-paid drug rep. It was his job to elbow his way gracefully into doctors' offices, to open up his expense account, and to use his charm with receptionists and medical assistants, and ultimately with the doctor.
By and large, we are a bright beam of sunshine that comes in through that gray cloud in the waiting room. And we usually come bearing gifts, such as pens, pads, a free meal. And we're there for, ostensibly, the doctor's sake. We're there to foster that friendship.
Sharon soon decided that what he was doing was not necessarily in the best interests of the people who needed the drugs, and that he wasn't really the scientific pharmaceutical rep he'd imagined he might be. He was in sales. A look inside the recruitment and the life of a drug rep. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging is holding a hearing today. It's called Under the Influence, Can We Provide Doctors with an Alternative to Biased Drug Reviews? Now, the man who's the lead witness at that committee today is my guest. Sharon Mahari was a pharmaceutical sales representative with Eli Lilly. It was his job to persuade doctors to prescribe drugs like Prozac. Now, Sharon's not going to the committee to speak against the drugs or against Eli Lilly. He's there to talk about the high-pressure tactics that he used when he talked to doctors. This was something Sharon had no idea about when he graduated from college. All he remembers is that he was eager for a challenge and a chance to make some money. His roommate told him that Eli Lilly was looking for people. Sharon said he wasn't sure what he was getting into.
One manager asked me to sell a pen, and at that point, I hadn't done any selling at all in my entire life. And so she left the room. She said, I'll give you a minute or two to prepare. And I had to think of a compelling reason why she would want to buy a pen that she just handed me. And I sounded like an infomercial. It was ridiculous.
But had you thought at this point, this is what I'm here for. This is what I'm going to do.
No, actually, that's a strange thing. I thought it was less about sales and simply more about relaying information. I was still convinced that was the crux of the job. And having shadowed, part of the training process or interview process was that I get to shadow actual people in the job to see what it's like and to get a strong sense of it. And from what I had seen, a lot of the job was rapport building. And I love to make friends. I'm comfortable moving to new environments and meeting new people and asking them about who they are and getting to know them. And to me, that just sounded like I was being paid to do something that I naturally do and enjoy.
So take me back to that first interview. How did you sell the pen?
Miserably. When it came down to the bare nuts and bolts of selling, I told her, this is a fantastic pen. This is incredible. Look how well it writes. How could you not want this pen? For what possible reason could you not want this pen? And it was a really ridiculous effort on my part. I was overly enthusiastic, almost comically enthusiastic about a pen, and just trying to elicit some sort of response and hoping that some of my enthusiasm would rub off on her in some magical, mysterious way.
Did you get any feedback?
Thank you. We'll give you a call.
We don't want the pen today.
Yeah, pretty much.
But the recruiters at Eli Lilly saw something in Sharon. He was called back for a second round of interviews. This time he felt relaxed, especially at the end of his last interview.
This one particular moment was fantastic with my manager. He said he was going to leave the office for a little bit, and this is at the tail end of the interview. And he said that if there's anything that would make you a particularly effective sales rep, let me know. But I'm going to go out of the office for a second. I just have to get something. I'll be back in a few minutes. And I couldn't really think of anything. But as soon as he opened the door and walked in, it's as if some sort of script was delivered to the forefront of my mind. And I told him, I'm well integrated into the culture. And on top of that, I'm a pretty friendly guy. And I know the science. I can actually talk science with them as well. Not only do I know who they are and what they talk about, I know where they're going and what they want. You can't find a better person than me. And I probably said it a little bit more convincingly then. But the gist of it was that I did what we call in the business, closed him. And I didn't even realize I was doing it at the time. And that's probably actually the best sign that you're doing a very, very capable close, that you're just doing it very naturally. And I think I said it with enough sincerity in my voice that he was sure that this person would be useful. And after that, it just became a question of which manager wanted me more, him or another manager.
Well, because you have someone who is – then you have people competing for you.
Yeah, actually. I remember the other manager, I had to meet him in Grand Central Station. and that we had coffee and we were discussing the nature of the job, and he was gauging my interest. And then when I finally did get the offer, it was in the lobby of a hotel in New York, in Manhattan. It seemed very, I don't know, it seemed like something out of a spy movie, these brief encounters with random people I've never met before, given explicit instructions as to where to stand and who to look out for and what color jacket I'm wearing.
And how good was the offer?
Very good. To someone coming fresh out of college, I think the base salary was somewhere in the realm close to about $50,000. I would get a car, insurance, health plan, cell phone, bills paid, stock options, 5 bonuses, and the job gave me a great degree of autonomy. Hard to say no to that.
Did you get an expense account on top of that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I forgot to mention that. I had an incredible expense account. I think by the time I was done, I knew all the maitre d's of the finest Manhattan restaurants on a first-name basis.
And you were how old at the time, Sharon?
23.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Once Sharon was hired as a pharmaceutical rep, he was told to report for training. He remembers walking into the room with his new colleagues for the first time.
I was surrounded by 499 of some of the most attractive people I've ever met, and I couldn't help but wonder how the heck I snuck under the radar and got into that room.
What do you mean? What's the contrast you're talking about here?
Well, the women were mostly young, attractive, energetic, vivacious, fun, intelligent people. The men were model athletes, these iconic, broad-shouldered superhero guys. And then there was a couple of the regular Joes like myself who, through charm or whatever you might want to call it, managed to work our way in there. I think when it came down to it, the one thing we all had in common was actually that we were all fun, charming people. We were all affable people.
Did you think at the beginning maybe that you didn't fit in?
Well, there's one incident in particular that made me realize that I definitely didn't fit in. In the training class that we were in, it was a neuroscience division, which we were taught was the creme de la creme. We sold the two products that constituted over 50% of the company's profits. So we had been groomed to think that we were the elite of the sales force. And going into my sales class of 23 people, including the instructors, on the first day, I had to explain how two brain cells, two nerve cells, actually communicate to one another. It is a pretty simple process, and if you're selling an antidepressant or an antipsychotic, very, very important. But I realized then and there that even the two instructors and of all my classmates, no one had any college-level science background. And it sent shivers down my spine because I sort of realized that, am I the only guy who knows this basic science stuff? And if so, what does that say about the nature of our job? And then I saw my first paycheck and quickly dismissed that thought.
It didn't matter anymore.
Right.
What were you taught in sales school? What was it that they told you that made you pause and reconsider what you were doing?
I didn't really get a chance to pause in sales school. They really do a great job of integrating you into the company culture and getting you enthusiastic about the products. But looking back on it now, I probably should have paused if I was a little bit more careful. Sales school, you have to keep in mind, was about an 8-to-6 job, and you go back to your condos with the other trainees, and you have homework, and you live together, you work together. And actually, at the headquarters, they have a cafeteria, they have a gym, they have an entertainment center, and they have a health clinic. It's really its own enclosed environment, so that you're essentially breathing the company culture in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
How long does this go on, sales school?
Well, mine actually lasted about 6 weeks, and I think that was on the long end. But it's long enough that you get a fair sense of what the science is, or basic sense of what the science is, and then, more importantly, a lot of the time is spent in crafting your detail. The detail is the business term we use for your message or your pitch. And so we all learned how to matter-of-factly go down an algorithm in our mind to be able to suss out what the doctor's complaints are about our products or why they wouldn't possibly use it or why they see it as being weak or strong, and then capitalize on those arguments through rehearsed counter-arguments and make it a really convincing and tailored conversation without even having the person, having our client realize that that's exactly what we're doing.
What were the drugs that you were asked to sell then, Cheryl?
I sold two blockbusters. So my job was actually pretty easy. I sold Prozac, which is now gone generic, and I sold Zyprexa, which is an antipsychotic that's still making a lot of money.
When did you find out what you really had to do? How did that happen?
Well, I've got to tell you, for all my pretensions of being a smart guy, it took me an awfully long time. When I left sales school, I was convinced that my two products were going to save everyone's lives, and the only thing that's actually preventing me from helping all those poor, sick people are ignorant doctors. And I wasn't alone in that mentality. I think probably 90% of the reps who come out of sales school feel the same way. And then about 6 months into the job, you get enough feedback from the clients, from the doctors, to realize that, you know what, maybe my product isn't the best in every circumstance. And then after perhaps about a year or so, I bothered to go back to the science and I guess more critically analyze the data that I was disseminating to the clients, to the doctors. And I began to realize that I'm really painting a very, very skewed image of my products, which isn't to say that they weren't good or helpful, but just that maybe I was over-exaggerating how helpful, how good they were. You might say I drank the Kool-Aid.
Prozac is the brand name for fluoxetine hydrochloride.
In correcting an existing chemical imbalance, thereby improving mood and creating a feeling of well-being. Prozac is available in 10, 20, and 40 milligram doses and can be found in both tablets and capsules. Take fluoxetine with water and never take extra doses. Once you have been taking fluoxetine regularly...
In just a moment, I'll follow Cheryl Mahari as he takes his new training as a pharmaceutical rep out on the road. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. It's not just doctors and pharmaceutical reps who trade in the sale and promotion of drugs. We get that pitch ourselves all the time.
If you're a guy with high cholesterol or diabetes, Levitra is proven to help treat your ED.
Ask your doctor if you are healthy enough for sexual activity. If you have heart problems or are on alpha blocker therapy, talk to your doctor before taking Levitra. Do not take Levitra if you take nitrates for chest pains, as this may cause an unsafe drop in blood pressure. Side effects may...
You know what I mean. You watch TV long enough and you'll find some drug that'll give you better sex, better sleep, more energy, clearer sinuses, and relief from indigestion. The effect of all the ads is clearly felt in the doctor's office. People tear a page out of a magazine, they take it to the doctor, and they say, "This says it'll make me better. I want that." My guest today is Cheryl Mahari. He spent close to 2 years as a pharmaceutical rep with Eli Lilly, and he says the dark mood of the doctor's waiting room is often the best place for him to start as well.
Patients come in, they have complaints, they're ill, they're not happy. We are the welcome reprieve in the middle of the day that comes in not to complain, but to hear the doctor's complaints. And we usually come bearing gifts.
Such
as pens, pads, a free meal, information. I use that term very loosely. But by and large, we are a bright beam of sunshine that comes in through that gray cloud in the waiting room. And we're there for ostensibly the doctor's sake. We're there to hear what he or she has to say and how they're doing and how are their kids and how is life. And we're there to foster that friendship. Of course, the sinister thing is, and this was relayed to me by one of my instructors, when I told him a story about how I was really enjoying my time at dinner with some of my clients, he told me in no uncertain terms that when you're at dinner, you are sitting with a client, but they are sitting with a friend. And so in essence, we're getting paid to be their friend.
Give me an example of how you create a friendship.
Okay. Our training actually enables us to elevate this to a whole new sophisticated level. So, Dick, I know, for example, on the website that you are Canadian background, I would strike up a conversation about how my brother lives in Canada, my sister-in-law. I've visited Toronto many a times. I'm a big Canadiophile. I would inject an interesting anecdote. For example, this weekend, I don't know if you've ever done it, but I've actually gone lobster fishing off the coast of Los Angeles. If you ever get that opportunity, especially if you come out west, I highly recommend it. And by west, I mean Southern California and not Vancouver, because there's a whole different environment there. Now, in that particular anecdote that I mentioned, it's almost an invitation. Hopefully, you'll come out west and get an opportunity to do that. But at the same time, I also tie it in and say, when I say west, I mean California and not Vancouver, reiterating the fact that, again, I know that you have some sort of Canadian roots and that I'm trying to relate to you as a person. Now, Dick, the really interesting thing about this is that as soon as I'm done conversing with you, I go to my car where I have a laptop computer and I plug in all this information. And at night, when I log in my computer, that information goes to the mainframe and gets disseminated to all the drug reps that have you as a client. And so, if I happen to get your daughter's birthday, for example, out of you, 6 months later when it's her birthday and my partner comes in with a cake for you to celebrate your daughter's birthday, you're not going to remember that you told me and not my partner. You're just going to think these reps are really, really thoughtful. They're really considerate.
Have you done this? Have you brought in a cake or used the information?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's essential to the business. It's not only information on you, but we compile data on people in your office as well. Most notably, what we call the gatekeepers, your secretaries. If they like coffee a certain way, if they have a particular fondness for a certain type of flower, if they enjoy a particular donut, when are their birthdays? We tend to have to please them to maintain access to you as the physician.
Let me ask you something, though, Sharon, because most of the doctors that I know, all the doctors that I know are pretty smart people. They would all know that you work for Eli Lilly and that
Absolutely.
Makes you a drug rep. And that means that at some point or another, you're going to, you know, open your briefcase and say, here's some stuff that I want you to read about Prozac. And so all this kind of dancing around to manufacture this friendship that we're talking about, aren't the doctors going to be aware of that?
Absolutely. They are very well aware of it. They realize. But there was a really interesting study. It was a questionnaire to physicians. And it's asked a simple question. How vulnerable are you to drug rep marketing? Not at all, very little, or a lot? And most physicians said not at all or very little. And then the question was turned on its head. Well, what about your peers? And then you got exactly the opposite response. I'm perfectly invulnerable to this type of marketing, but my peers are complete suckers. And we as drug reps actually have to maintain that and cultivate that illusion. And we work in teams. So whereas the doctor perhaps spends about 5 minutes gauging what their interaction with the drug rep is going to be, we spend a good 45 minutes plotting out the strategy, the exact psychological techniques, breaking down your personality, and figuring out which of our gifts will have the most impact in swaying your prescribing.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Sharon Mahari says he learned that if a doctor spent just 1 minute with a drug rep, chances are he'd end up writing about 16% more prescriptions for that rep's product. And if the meeting was 4 minutes long, the jump in prescription writing would be over 50%. Now, one way Sharon would entice doctors is through the little trinkets he'd bring with him into the office. Pens, pads, just stuff.
And the funny thing is that the smaller the gift, the greater the urge to return the favor. A single pen or pad is obviously not going to sway a doctor to write that prescription. But it's this general gift-giving culture that just accumulates this sense of reciprocity in you. We don't just give you one pen or one pad. We flood your clinic with them. We flood your office with them.
I'm glad you mentioned the pens and the pads, because every time you do make reference to them, I think to myself, this is a doctor we're talking about. How could someone like that be courted with a pen?
Yeah, exactly. It's I hate to say it, but there's a great sense of entitlement that sometimes affects physicians. We specifically target the ones who have that sense of entitlement, because I think they become more vulnerable to sales pitches.
Why is it that a company, any drug company, will spend so much money and so much time and so much effort trying to get one doctor to prescribe one drug? I mean, the money that they pay you, your expense account, all that, is it worth the while?
Yeah, it's drug reps are the big money makers for these companies. And these personal relationships are very, very effective. We're not prescribing medications that are used for 1 week and then you throw them away. This is depression and schizophrenia. These are lifetime diseases. And so if you have a person who's going to start on your medication, chances are, unless something goes horribly wrong with the medication, they're going to stay on it for a lifetime.
So in fact, getting the doctor to write that very first prescription for that one patient could mean, I don't know, what, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 spent on that drug over a period of time.
Right, and that's just one patient. And now when you're dealing with physicians and you're swaying them two or three patients a week, or if you're convincing an emergency room psychiatric clinic to use your product as a first-line choice. I remember one breakfast I had, I'd convinced the ER director in one psychiatric clinic to use Zyprexa, and I did a rough tabletop on-the-napkin calculation afterwards, and just by estimating the flow of patients, conservatively speaking, that one brief breakfast meeting generated several millions of dollars over the course of a year.
Millions of dollars?
Millions of dollars. The pharmaceutical industry is perhaps – no, no perhaps. It is definitively the most lucrative, most profitable industry as a class.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. My guest is Sharon Mahari. He worked as a drug rep for nearly 2 years. He found out that he had a knack for getting to doctors. Now remember, he was 23. He was working the offices of doctors in Manhattan. And he was cocky enough to go where no drug rep had gone before.
One doctor was one of the biggest script writers in the New York area, the greater New York area. And he had a no-rep policy. In other words, he refused to meet with the drug reps. And I was insistent on going to meet this doctor. He was very, very important for our business. And my partner thought I was crazy because this person would most likely chew my head off and throw my carcass out in the street. But I wanted to do it anyway. And I went to his office. I waited in the waiting room for about 45 minutes until he finally came out, this tall gentleman with a beard. He said, "Are you the drug rep?" I said, "Yes, I am, sir." I shook his hand. He said, "Come back to my office." I followed him in. And when I walked into his office, I did exactly what my training had taught me to do. And I looked at his room. I looked for personal details, personal effects. I made this seem very matter-of-fact, very nonchalant. But I'd already recognized one possible way I can connect to him as a person. And there's a picture on the wall of his son at a college that I was very familiar with. And then I looked up, actually, and apparently he went to medical school at the same institution as his son went to undergrad. So I thought this is perfect. And as he went around his desk and sat down, he said, "Oh, take a good look at my office. Do you like it?" And I already had, but now I made a more obvious viewing of his room. And I said, "Yeah, it's a very beautiful office, Dr. X." He said, "I'm glad you like it. It's the last time you're going to see it. Now get out."
That was it?
No.
He invited you back to throw you out, basically, is what
exactly.
He planned.
That's exactly what he was planning. And that was to give me a clear-cut message that I was not welcome there. And I was crestfallen, and I had turned around and was slowly walking to the door. And somewhere between leaving the base of his desk and getting to the door with my hand on the knob, I came up with a strategy. And I turned around and said, "Listen, Dr. X, I've got to tell you, this is just a temporary job. I'm actually pre-med. I'm really interested in going into medicine. This is just a way for me to make ends meet, and I'm not really involved in this process." And I think that may have just been the opening I needed to get to connect to him as a person.
None of this was true, right? You weren't pre-med. You weren't planning on going to that institution. You were just – this was your line.
No. I think at the time I actually thought a fair bit of conviction that, yeah, this is actually true. Not entirely. You know, there's a great deal of gray. I'm making good money. I don't want to give it up now to go into medicine. But, you know, it's sort of a gray truth, you might say.
Sounds pretty calculating to me, Sharon.
It's like a chess game. And I think that's actually one of the things that made me want to leave.
So take me back to this guy's office, though. You said, I'm pre-med. I'm just, you know, putting in time as a drug rep. I'm guessing you didn't open your briefcase and start unloading pads and pens.
No, not at all. I knew that would be the quickest way for me to get kicked out of that office. But I did play – I played my own version of the good cop, bad cop game with this person. He refused to see anyone else, including my partners. But on occasion, your manager rides with you. And so I would play both sides of the fence and say, "Listen, Dr. X, my manager's coming in. He's going to ride with me on such and such a day. And, you know, you're a big trophy prize a big feather in my cap for having been able to see you. Do you mind if I just come in and we'll pretend that I'm going to sell you on something? He wants to make sure that I'm doing my job. So we'll just pretend. And then I would go to my manager and say, listen, I told Dr. X that we're coming in. I told him we're going to pretend to sell, but I'm going to do the light sell. And why don't you give him a little push and see if you can be the bad cop on this?
I have to tell you, I'm getting confused now. Who are you scamming, your own manager or the doctor?
You know? Dick, that's the funny thing about this is that, I mean, you become trained, so skilled, so capable at crafting a conversation that it becomes a subconscious routine. And in this case, I was scamming both the client and my manager to make myself look great in front of my manager, but also see if I can push the client to give me a few more prescriptions and to show that my relationship has actually yielded a tangible financial result.
But this was also the beginning of Sharom Ahari's misgivings about what he was doing. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Sharom says he began to notice that he was using his salesman's wiles in his personal relationships. And he wasn't that crazy about these forced friendships with doctors either. It was that same tough doctor who eventually got to him.
When I finally did grow a conscience, and when I finally did listen to it, he's one of the first people I went to and confessed exactly what I was doing.
What did you say to him?
I told him, listen, I'm getting out. I'm finally getting out of the business, and I've got to tell you that I've been playing you against my manager from time to time, and sometimes it was calculated, and it's really been weighing on my mind, and I can't take it anymore. I don't want to be that kind of person.
Let me just back up a little bit here, because I need to kind of understand the tone of that particular meeting. This doctor we're talking about, mm-hmm. Did he become your friend?
Yeah, actually, he was my friend. And actually, we are still friends now, although it certainly strained the relationship when I came out and confessed everything.
And you told him what? You told him that you'd been faking the friendship?
No, that I've actually leveraged the friendship to make myself look good in front of the manager and on occasion tried to actually subtly introduce ploys here and there to see if I can influence how he's prescribing.
What did he say?
He just had a look of disgust. He didn't have to say anything, and I felt like I had been punched in the gut. I felt pretty guilty about it.
Beyond what that person's thinking about you, what are you thinking about yourself?
Oh, I went through a rather dire identity crisis. I mean, I was playing these games. I trained so well and having done it so long, I took like a fish to water. I was in conversations with my family, with my mom. I would think, okay, this is what I want out of the conversation. This is how I'm going to steer it. Same with my girlfriend. I want her to come out and meet me for dinner, and this is how I'm going to position her and leverage her, even though I know she's busy and doesn't want to. And that's actually one of the things that made me take some responsibility for it.
I'm wondering, Sharom, if there was ever a time when you worked as a drug rep, when you thought to yourself that what you were doing might have been good for you, might have been good for the doctor, but was there a time when you thought maybe what you were doing wasn't that great for the people who were taking the drugs?
Yeah. There is one doctor I remember in Brooklyn who I had many conversations with, scientific conversations discussing the mechanistic profile of our drug, saying how great it was, what neurotransmitters it affected, 101 reasons why he should use Prozac over his choice of drug. And he was adamant. He would rebut with more science than I was capable of competing with, and he had a very sound scientific argument as to why he doesn't want to use Prozac. And then I took him out to dinner. And after dinner, I saw that our numbers were going up. I took him out to dinner again, and our numbers kept going up. And I knew that it wasn't because I had convinced him academically. I had convinced him subconsciously because he felt he owed me a favor or something along those lines. And that dinner was powerfully convincing to generate a lot of sales for us. And it made me think about those patients. And I realized that those patients aren't getting Prozac because it's what the doctor thinks is the best drug for them. They're getting Prozac by virtue of the fact that I took him out to dinner. I've swayed a physician's clinical decision-making, not with science, not with objective data, but with a meal, with foie gras.
You're studying medicine now, right?
No, I studied public health, and I'm actually applying to medicine. So hopefully this time next year I'll be a medical student.
Someday you might be a doctor.
If all goes according to plan.
And would you let the drug reps in?
Me? I'm immune to them. No, I don't think I would. I don't think they have much to offer me that I can't get myself. Information, I can get it myself. Samples, there are other ways to get medications for my patients. Data, there are more objective sources of information for my patients. Pens, I can buy them myself. I won't let them in.
Sharon Mahari worked as a pharmaceutical rep. Today, he's testifying about the biased drug advice that's given to doctors. And he's testifying at a special Senate committee in Washington. When I'm back in just a minute, I'll talk with someone who also found himself vaulted into a completely unfamiliar world and has thrived in it. This story takes us from Congo to Carolina. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I find that one inexhaustible source of remarkable stories here are those about how people came to this country and what they do once they get here. Recently, I talked with a guy who designed Florida's new immigration centers. He is himself an immigrant and brings that to his work. Today's Your Story is about a man who came to the U.S. from one of the most remote and rural places on Earth. Godi Godar was born and raised in Ikoko in Congo, a place with no running water, no phones, no electricity.
There was electricity across the lake. That's where the missionary, they have their own private generators, and during the night, we can see the light.
Did you sit on the shore of the lake and look across?
Yeah. I remember. I said, wow, look at the lights there. It was a trip.
Godi Godar says it was a wonderful place to be a small boy. There was, of course, no TV, no internet. There weren't even any toys. But Godi and his pals had acres of wild country to explore and hunt in.
Oh, we hunt porcupines and antelopes, sort of like a deer. And
what did you use? Did you have...
We used spears and bow and arrows. Occasionally, we will run into the dangerous situations, like maybe large snakes, about 18 feet long. So those can be very deadly, so you don't want to mess around. But we did kill one with one of my friends, because the same snake killed the two dogs we were hunting with.
And the snake killed your dogs?
Yeah.
This a constrictor?
Yeah.
So had the snake eaten the dogs?
Yeah, the snakes killed our dogs. And then we have to escape, because that time is very dangerous. You don't want to get close to it. They will swallow the whole thing, and then it will stay there until it digested a week. And me and my friend, we went there and speared it.
Because when the snake is digesting a meal like that, it's not very fast, right?
No, not very fast.
How big around was this?
It was snake, like a foot wide.
A foot across?
Yeah. Then when a swallow thing, it can be maybe more, maybe
it stretched a lot.
Yeah, 2 or 3 feet wide.
How old were you when you killed this snake?
I was about 14.
What did you do with a dead snake that
size? We cut the snake parts, and we opened the dogs. The dogs, of course, were dead. Then we eat the snakes. It was very good.
How do you cook a boa constrictor?
We have a special lath from a jungle. We will put those lath together, and you put a meat there and put anything, spices.
So you're wrapping it in this
wrap
meat.
Wrap it and put in a hot coal, and it stays there for several days. And by the time it's done, it's a delicacy. It's very tasty.
What's it taste like?
Tastes more like a chicken.
Why did I know you were going to say that? So if you were hunting and fishing as a young boy, did you ever have time to play, ever have time to just do stuff that you wanted to do?
One time I remember me getting a little trees, and I made my own canoe. That's more entertainment.
A canoe that you could actually paddle?
Yeah, definitely. And I made it a canoe, and I put it in a lake.
Did you use it for fishing or just?
It was just more for fun, because it was small enough. It's easy to tip over. And we can make our own toys, and we collect wires. So collect the green and orange, and we put it together, and 4 wheels, and make it sort of like a car.
But as kids, did you even see cars?
No. I never see the car. First time I see the car, I was like 20 already years old.
But you would make little cars to play with?
Yeah.
How would you know what to make?
We have pictures. Sometimes people travel from Kinshasa, they will show us, look at how this is a car looks like. So that was my memories. And the car, it looks like this, so I can make something. Or bicycle, it looks like
I've
this.
I've seen the little wire bicycles. Yeah. Now, to travel from Ikoko to the closest road, how long would that distance be?
From Ikoko to Bikoro, that's 3 hours or more.
In canoe.
In canoe.
And one of my favorite parts of Godi Godar's story of making his way to the U.S. is that when he finally settled here, he needed a job. Now, here's a guy who saw his first car when he was 20 years old. Naturally, he's now a mechanic. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Godi says the difficult route out of his village of Ikoko meant that it was a big event for some to visit or to leave. One day, Godi had what he calls a vision.
I had it as a dream in me. I will go far away and then I will be taking care of a family back here. I will be sending the money. It was like my core of my purpose of the life.
What was in the dream?
It was just show me clearly and I would just leave the village. And
so it was an image of you leaving. You didn't see yourself in some foreign land.
No. It was just showing me I'm going to be leaving. And that reality of being in a village with a family and everybody take care of you, they raise you, and that sit in my mind, and then I will just leave the village.
Do you remember what it was like when you woke up from the dream?
It was kind of surprising, and then I was exciting after that dream.
You weren't frightened?
No. I was not
frightened. You weren't thinking, I don't want to leave. This is my home.
It was no doubt at all in my mind. Just then I woke up and then my dad was not there, but I talked to my mom.
And what did she say?
She's asking me, where are you going to be gone? I said, I don't know, Mom.
How old were you again when
this
happened?
I was 14, yeah.
And did you tell your brothers and sisters?
No, I didn't tell anybody else. Only my mom knew that.
And did you keep this like a secret?
Yeah.
How long?
It was for a long time until I met the American, and then I knew. And the day I met the American in the village, then a clerk says, oh, I'm going to go to America.
The American visitor to Godi's village in Congo was a missionary. This guy, Dean, lived with Godi's family for a time, learning the language, but then he left. Godi Godar stayed behind, and he thought his own chance to leave was gone as well. Now, Godi was telling me that even to this day in those remote parts of the Congo, messages are passed from village to village by drum. Letters, well, they take a little longer. One day, months after the missionary's departure, a letter arrived.
I was like, wow!
What did it say?
Dear Godi Godar, I would like to invite you to come to the United States. Just like that.
And what do you think?
I said, this is a blessing and I give thanks. I'm going to go. And then I had to sit with my grandfather and my mom and their dad. They asked me, so what do you think? Then I did told my, I have this dream. I told my mom. So
but
here I am.
What did you think, though? Was there a part of you that wanted to stay in Ikoko?
No, it was no part of me to stay in Ikoko.
And did your family send you away willingly, or did your mother want you to stay, your grandfather want you to stay?
My dad is being a chief in the village, and so I'm the oldest child, and I didn't want to become a chief in the village, so I just decided I cannot do that. If you want to be a chief, you have to be staying there and learn everything, so you cannot leave the village.
Did anybody say to you, don't go, stay here?
They did not. They give me the blessing, and I give my brother the blessing, and everybody blessed me. Then we left in the middle of the night and across the lake, and my dad and my mom, and then I left.
Why did you leave in the middle of the night?
Because sometimes it can be a curse. They believe in the villages, it's like everybody will know I'm leaving, and then it can be something happen.
So you can bring trouble on the village or trouble on yourself if you leave in the daytime?
Trouble to myself, yeah.
Because you're seen leaving, right?
Right.
So this way you kind of like have to sneak out.
Right. Yeah.
When you left that night, were you traveling by yourself at that time, once you said goodbye to your parents?
Yeah.
What was that like, saying goodbye to them?
It was hard and a little confused in a way. Then it's going to take a while me to see them again, and very difficult. And it was so strong feelings, and that is I will go and then be provider for the family.
Was there a lot of crying?
Yeah.
But never, you didn't once say, okay, this is a bad idea, I'm going to stay.
No.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Gordy Godar had a lot to learn about the United States. He arrived in New York in the middle of winter. He noticed that there were no leaves on any of the trees.
Wow, all the American trees are dead? and they laugh so hard. He says, no, they're not dead. They are asleep.
It must have felt like you were on a different planet.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I didn't know what the difference is between the cold and the hot. And I went to take a shower. I just turned the cold knob. I was freezing. I could not take anymore. I stopped. I went there. Oh, you guys take a cold water all the time? And they laughed at me. It was so funny. We just laughed.
And he showed you where the hot water
Yeah, Dean went there and says, this is how you do it. They say, wow, this is fantastic.
You know, I remember talking to a family that came to America from Sudan. And one of the things that they had a lot of difficulty with was stairs, because where they'd grown up, there were no stairs. And these people were given a bedroom in a house up on the second floor. And so they'd come down in the morning and they'd be walking slowly, slowly on the stairs because they didn't want to fall. What do you remember that was difficult for you to get used to in your first few days?
The village, I know everybody. And they hear, I will wave at people, and then they were just like,
Who is that guy?
Who is this guy? I will smile, and they would not even look at you. And then I start to feeling homesick. I was very, very homesick. And I remember that year, it snows. It was really, really one of the biggest snow, and I never see the snow before.
Did you think about going home? Did you think maybe this is just too much?
Yeah, I felt like it was more discouraged. Yeah, I felt like, wow, this is no fun. I'm used to around the people all the time.
Knowing everybody, being able to speak
exactly,
with everyone.
Sharing and laughing and all that stuff. Not anymore. I used to go in bed, I would cry.
And the thing is, you would have no way of speaking with your family. You couldn't pick up the phone and say, Mom, I'm missing you, or anything like that. Did that make it worse?
Yeah.
How long did that go on?
6 months, and then my language started to getting better, and then, of course, being able to communicate with the people more.
Gordy Godar soon found a home in a small community not far from Chapel Hill. And that's when this guy who'd never driven, never even seen a car as a young man, decided he wanted to be a mechanic.
It was very strange for me to see how cars move, since I never seen things like that.
You hadn't seen a car until you were 20 years old, right?
Right. And how the television works, I remember even in Kinshasa, I went behind the TV to look at it. I thought the people maybe behind that, hiding. And me seeing the things move, I thought some type of magic in there. I wanted really to learn these type of things. So that's it made me like I wanted to become a mechanic. So I want to be able to understand how these things are functioning.
Was it hard for you to learn?
I just learned English, and now I'm learning technical words. It's like, wow, what is this? I learned very quick. I can always watch, and then it all come together. And I remember making one mistake. We're working on the brakes. I didn't know how really the brakes works. And after done, I supposed to pump the pedal to build the pressure.
Yeah.
And then I didn't do it. And I put the car on the reverse and then keep on going. I tried to hit. And when I hit another car, everybody was just like, oh, wow.
People saying, maybe you don't want to be a mechanic, Gordy. Maybe you want to be a carpenter or something like that. Why did you stay with it, though? Why did
I just decided I can do this. And never doubting in myself. And I said, no matter how, I will never give up. I stay in with it until I get it. I worked with a bus company, and then I decided to work on my own. And I have my little shop at the community now.
You stay busy?
Yeah. Some days it's busy. Some days it gets slow. So,
are you a good mechanic?
Yeah, I am.
Did you ever get to go back to Ikoko?
No, not ever since.
You've never been home?
Not yet.
So if you've never been back to Ikoko, have you seen your mother and father since?
Yes, they came, and my mom and dad, they came.
They came here to the U.S.?
Yeah, they came in the U.S. They stayed for 6 months. And they were really proud of me, and they love the people in the community. They says, wow, you have a family here.
What did they think about your new skill as a mechanic?
My dad was very, very stunned. And one day I remember he came to my shop, and then I was rebuilding engines. And I took the whole thing apart, and he was there just watching me. And
you had an entire engine apart on the floor. Right?
Yeah. He says, how can you do this? And he was sitting there and staring at me and looking at the engines and my mom and tears. And the day I fired it. And like,
you turned the key?
Yeah. It was like, wow. It was very exciting.
So they're proud of you.
There, yeah. They told me, they says, that was a good decision for you to come, and you have done so much to the village and helping your siblings going to school. And
I wanted to ask you about that. You had said to me when you had this dream, when you were a kid, your dream told you that you would move far away and then help out people in the village. So in the last 20 years now, have you sent money back to the village?
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of money?
For them, it's a lot, like $200. That is, it goes a long way.
And they use it for what, Cody? What are
they use it to build the school.
They don't use money in the village, right? They use it to buy supplies outside?
Yeah, to buy supplies in Kinshasa and get to the village.
And so what do you think? When you were just a young boy, you said you knew this was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it looks like you're right. But I don't know how you knew all those years ago that it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Do you know that? Do you know the answer?
That dream kept me really, this is what you have to do. And it was in me, and that dream came through. It just set me up.
Do you think you'll ever go back to Ikoko?
Definitely, I will go back and at least go visit. And I have a kid here, Joshua, is 8 years old, going to school. And,
is he curious about where his dad came from?
He always asks about the animals and how I grew up not having a TV or electricity, no water running or that things, and how big is it? It was the snake.
And he's how old?
He's 8.
If he said to you, oh, Dad, I had this vision. I have to go. I have to go to a land far, far away, and I may never see you again. What would you tell him?
It's going to be hard.
Would you let him go?
Yeah, I will let him go. I will let him go. Too far is a dream.
Cody Godard joined me here in the studio in Chapel Hill just before he left. I did what I often do, check the pronunciation of his name so I get it right. Cody told me that Cody Godard is actually kind of a nickname. His real name? That's another story.
Being the old child in the family, I receive all my ancestors' names. So my whole name is Moteke Molanga Musika Moliki Namboka Ebosuku Ekendeke Lankanga Ilia Kankuansoso Etika Kamotuako Ongokonzala Olensi Nalobenge Nsi Nkamotopo Nyam Nkamotopo Elendiriwe Namoto Yilelen Kobotio. And that's why they call me Cody Godard.
That's a very long name. It's a good thing you don't have to put this on your driver's license. You know?
Exactly.
This is music that Cody recommended. It is by Taboulet Rochereau with L'Africain Fiesta Nationale. The name of the song is Likala Yamoto. My name's Dick Gordon. That's all. Easy to remember. You can find me on our website at thestory.org. And go there if you have suggestions for stories that you'd like me to know about. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.